Welcome to episode 439 of That Triathlon Show, the podcast presented by scientifictriathlon.com. I'm your host Michael, and on today's episode I do a solo coaching thoughts style episode on the topic of overrated factors for triathlon performance. In this episode, we will go through a list of 11 of these factors, including factors from categories like gear and equipment, metrics, training concepts, and I'd be glad to hear your feedback on any or all of these things later. Feel free to email me. You can find my email on scientifictriathlon.com or even in the episode description, I believe. By the way, I hope that the title here isn't too clickbaity. I didn't set out to make a list-based episode, actually, but in my initial drafts of the script, I had a lot of good ideas, but couldn't really tie things together and make things clear and coherent. And then I realized that reformatting to a list-based episode actually kind of worked really nicely, which in turn led to the title. So hopefully you can forgive me for that if it seems a bit clickbaity and if it is a bit clickbaity. But I hope that the depth of the content clearly demonstrates that that it wasn't meant in that way. But I guess your feedback will tell me if I got that right or wrong. But before we dive into the content for today, let's thank our sponsors, Precision Fuel and Hydration. They create carbohydrate and electrolyte products that are effective, practical, and tasty. They're effective because they contain just the things that we know work, so glucose, fructose, caffeine in the caffeine gels, and sodium, and in the right amounts and nothing else. They are practical because they're based on increments of 30 grams of carbs and 500 milligrams of sodium, so it's really easy to keep track of how much you consume, and if you want to consume 60 grams, it's easy, 90 grams, it's easy, 120 grams, it's easy. And similarly with sodium, of course. And they are tasty, but not in a very flavorful way, but in a neutral, mildly sweet way. And for me personally, they have been far easier to consume in higher amounts than other products that I tried, as I don't get flavor fatigue anymore due to the milder and more neutral taste of the Precision Fuel and Hydration carbohydrate products. They also produce great content on their blog and newsletter, which is genuinely really helpful and very well researched. So if you haven't checked out these resources, there's a lot of great stuff there about fueling and hydration. And as a listener, you can get 15% off your first order by using the code TTS24 on precisionfuelandhydration.com. And thank you to Zenate. The Zenate indoor swim trainer allows you to improve your technique, power, and swim training consistency. For a lot of athletes, the limitation to swim training is that it can be very time-consuming to swim when you consider everything that goes into a swim, including commuting to the pool and all of the faff that you may have to go through at the pool before actually getting into the water and so on. And this means that for a lot of people, it might only be realistic to swim once or twice per week. With the Zenate, you can complement that pool swimming with quick and efficient home-based workouts that challenge the swim-specific muscles, so you can increase that all-important frequency of training and give yourself a chance to keep improving your swimming even when your pool time is limited. You can try the Zenate risk-free for 30 days and get 20% off your first order on zenatesimtrainer.com/TTS. Now, without any further ado, let's get into the main content for today, 11 overrated factors for triathlon performance. All right, so let's start with a bit of a preface here for this list. Firstly, when I say overrated, it doesn't mean useless. Many of the things that we will talk about here are still, by and large, very useful, or at least useful to some degree. Sometimes slightly useful, sometimes useful, sometimes very useful. But perhaps the usefulness is just a bit overstated. And so that's the first point I want to make. Secondly, as always, we have to appreciate the importance of context. And the way I have thought about this list is that within the context of the typical or average age group triathlete, amateur triathlete, but of course, nobody is the exact same as the average. So for an individual, one or many of these things that may be overrated on average might actually not be overrated at all for that individual. So we will discuss context with all of the factors here. Basically, we are discussing a list of factors that in the majority of cases may be a bit overrated, but it doesn't mean in every single case. That's really important to remember. And finally, not all of the items on this list are overrated to the same degree. Some items, I think, are without question overrated. And I think that it will be, even though I haven't ranked them in any way, this is not in an order of which ones are the most to least overrated or the other way around. But you will probably hear just in the way that I talk about them, which ones I think are the most overrated and which ones are much more nuanced. Others are a bit more out of left field, so to say, much more contextual, but even slightly maybe thought-provoking and there to generate some discussion, but basically overrated in certain contexts, but maybe not as much in others. So with that preface and all of that said, let's start going through the list, starting with factor number one, swimming. Now, this one is a bit controversial and very contextual. There are certainly a lot of people that underestimate swimming in triathlon, and you can see it if you go and watch something like an Ironman race, where a lot of people have not done the necessary preparation to actually be able to swim 3.8 kilometers, especially in open water conditions. If you only start swimming 1 to 2 months before a big A race and you swim once per week, you may fall into this category, for example. But I think that swimming can be overrated, and it is quite overrated by quite a few athletes and coaches, just from a very pragmatic, how much time is put into the swim compared to the return that you get from it in terms of time gained on the race course or position in the race compared to how much time you put into it. And this is, of course, much more the case in age group racing compared to professional racing. But actually, even in professional long course triathlon, there is the correlation between overall performance in the race and swim performance is quite poor, whereas the correlation between overall performance and bike performance and run performance is very strong. So there is even a case to be made on the professional side of things that maybe it is slightly overrated in long course non-draft triathlon. I do want to clarify. But here, let's go back to the age group perspective, because that is what we're mainly talking about here. The typical case I see where swimming might be overrated for an age group athlete is somebody who is already quite experienced and also a quite ambitious athlete. So they might be swimming 3 to 4 times per week. But when considering things like the commuting time, this adds up to many calendar hours, but it might not actually result in the athlete getting much faster. Or if they do get faster, we're maybe talking about 1 to 2 minutes over an Ironman. So for this athlete, cutting swimming back to twice per week and spending the extra time running or cycling can, in many cases, result in much better net gains in terms of race results. If the athlete has a very solid base of swim technique and fitness, they may even be able to go to one swim per week during some periods of the year, maybe during some of the winter months, and then add in a second swim when you get closer to the race and get into the specific preparation. Now, this is very individual. I've noticed that some athletes really lose a lot when they reduce the swimming past a certain level. So, for example, personally, I probably would not be able to do that. I would have to maintain at least 2 swims per week, and then maybe go up to 3 preparing for a race personally. But for some athletes, it seems to work quite well. Now, especially if you're in a very competitive age group category, you may never win your age group or even podium in your age group by really limiting your swim training like this. But also, podiuming or winning is not the goal for the vast majority of athletes. The vast majority of athletes, however, do want to get the best bang for buck in terms of overall finishing time and as a return on their training time invested. And in this case, if you belong to this category and you are a relatively experienced athlete with a foundation of swimming, you should consider whether you may be overrating the importance of the swim just in terms of how much time you spend doing it compared to how much you're getting out of it. Potentially, you stand to gain more by dedicating more time to cycling and running. And one final thing to say here is that when I say that if you are an experienced athlete with a decent foundation of swimming, decent foundation of swim technique and fitness, it doesn't mean that you're a very quick swimmer necessarily. It just means that you're at the point where you have been swimming for some years, perhaps, and the improvements that you're making at this point are generally small incremental improvements. So that is just to clarify where you might need to be in terms of your swimming level to fall into this category, typically, from my experience. But that is the end of point number one here, overrated factors for triathlon performance, swimming. Now, let's move on to number two, which is a metric, and this is the metric watts per kilogram. This one is much less contextual, and I have a pretty firm stance that the watts per kilogram metric, it doesn't matter whether we're talking about watts per kilogram over your chosen race distance, or even worse, potentially your threshold watts per kilogram. This is a metric that I consider vastly overrated in triathlon. The only exception to this would be certain very specific courses with huge amounts of climbing, like Ironman Nice, Alpe d'Huez Triathlon, and similar, when doing really long climbs, especially long steep climbs, then yes, watts per kilogram matters a lot. But most triathlon courses are not like that. Even most courses with a pretty decent amount of total elevation gain, they accumulate that elevation gain over quite rolling terrain where you're only climbing for a few minutes at a time. And in many cases, you can carry a pretty good speed over most of those climbs and on these types of courses. And on these courses, watts per kilogram is pretty insignificant, even though it may seem like it should be important if you have, for example, 1,500 meters of elevation gain over an Ironman bike leg. But to give you a quantitative example, I have used the CDA calculator on endurancedata.com to come up with these numbers. But let's say we have two athletes that are both riding an Ironman bike at 3 watts per kilogram. One weighs 80 kilograms and the other person weighs 55 kilograms. This means that the actual power they are riding at is 240 watts and 165 watts respectively. We're assuming here a flat course with no wind, so, and identical weather conditions otherwise as well, identical drivetrain efficiency and identical coefficient of rolling resistance CRR. I've assumed that the CDA of the bigger rider, the heavier rider, is 0.25, and for the smaller rider, 0.24, because generally speaking, as a smaller rider, you would have an easier time to get to a lower CDA. With these assumptions, the speed for the bigger rider will be 39.3 kilometers an hour, and for the smaller rider, 35.3 kilometers an hour. So a 4 kilometer per hour difference, which I'm sorry, I haven't prepared these in miles per hour, but that should be something like 2.5 miles an hour difference in speed, roughly speaking. Even if I make the smaller rider even more aerodynamic, so taking the CDA down to 0.22, which means that now we have a massive CDA difference of 0.25 compared to 0.22, then the smaller rider still only has a speed of 36.3 kilometers an hour, so going 1 kilometer an hour faster, and still that is 3 kilometers an hour slower than the faster rider with a much worse CDA. So even in this case, they would actually lose 22 minutes over the 180 kilometers of an Ironman bike. So basically, this shows you that even at identical watts per kilograms, the time differential over an Ironman bike comes down to something completely different. It comes down to watts per CDA. And this is a metric that has a very good correlation with speed in triathlon. Again, unless we're climbing mountains. So watts per CDA is something that you should look at instead. Of course, that is a much more difficult metric to measure, which is probably why it's not so used. But just because something is simple to measure doesn't mean that it's useful. And I think watts per kilogram falls squarely in that category. Even worse than using watts per kilogram to measure race performance. So for example, my Ironman race power is 3 watts per kilogram. Even worse than that is to use your threshold watts per kilogram as a measure of bike performance or bike ability. What we're doing in this case is that we take a metric that already correlates poorly with triathlon bike performance, watts per kilogram, but instead of reporting that metric for the actual race performance, we're reporting it to a kind of fuzzy threshold number. And as we all know, there are so many different ways that people measure and test thresholds that this watts per kilogram at threshold is pretty much a meaningless number, unless you also explain the exact protocol that you use to measure that threshold. But even then, if you do that, how that will translate into your race performance is just a question mark, because some people can hold a very high relative percentage of their threshold power at race pace and others a pretty low one. And it's not just about fitness either, it's also about skill and so on. That being said, in this criticism of using watts per kilogram at threshold, I should say that these issues that I just mentioned of the different ways of coming up with your threshold power or threshold watts per kilogram, those issues remain even if we report pure watts rather than watts per kilogram. So that's not just a question or a problem of watts per kilogram. But watts per kilogram in general, no matter if we're talking about race performance or as a threshold marker, is hugely overrated in triathlon because there are so few courses where this is actually meaningful. Overrated factor number 3 is power meters and power data. This one will shock a few people probably, but I will explain what I mean. Power meters and power data on the bike is incredibly useful and not overrated at all, in my opinion, when it comes to having an objective measure of external load for your training. In contrast to running, speed is not a good metric of external load on the bike because it is so impacted by terrain, wind, and anything that impacts your CDA or rolling resistance on the day. So for example, your equipment choice, are you on your mountain bike or on your time trial bike, and what tires are you using, what clothes are you using, what position are you in, and so on. With power, you can train consistently to your level day in, day out from an external load perspective. And as we have talked about many times, also combining that, of course, with internal load metrics like heart rate and RPE, power meters are amazing tools. I love them. What is overrated, and this is where you come to the crux of this point, is the accuracy of power meters. In my experience, most power meters these days tend to be very precise, so they are consistent day to day, assuming you calibrate as instructed by the manufacturer. But it doesn't mean that your 300 watts and your friend's 300 watts on different power meters are actually the same power. They may be quite significantly off. So I don't really have the data or the evidence to get into just how off they can be. We often see reports of 2% errors, but I think that the potential difference between power meters is just underrated. So basically, you don't want to compare your power data between different power meters, whether it's you comparing your power to your friend's power or you comparing your power on one bike to another bike if those two bikes use different power meters. I would say that this is actually the most common mistake that I see regarding power data and power meters, is to assume that you have two different devices to measure power meter. It might be two different power meters on two different bikes, or it might be your power meter for outdoor training and a smart trainer for indoor training. And to compare these and assume that they measure power exactly the same, that's a common mistake, because you might train outdoors one day and indoor the next day and see that, or even on two different bikes, and for the same effort, your power is 10, 15 watts off, and you make the assumption that you're fatigued or something like that, which is an assumption based on, or it's based on the assumption that the power meters are measuring your power exactly the same. So that's a very common mistake. You shouldn't do this between two different devices measuring power. And the second big mistake is, again, regarding comparisons with things like another person's power data or power meters. For example, you ride an Ironman bike leg at 200 watts and your friend does the same Ironman at 180 watts, but they are faster than you. The easy assumption to make here is that they are much more aerodynamic than you. And let's take any assumptions about drafting off the table here. But the reality is that you don't actually know if in reality you may be pushed the exact same power, or maybe they even pushed slightly more power than you. All you know is that they were faster than you. So then most likely, unless there are big differences in things like cornering and handling between the two of you, it means that their watts per CDA is higher than yours. But whether that comes from power or aerodynamics and in what proportions, that's not something that you can easily deduce, because the uncertainty of the power data from those two different sources of power can just be quite significant and should not be underestimated. And in this sense, that's what I mean when I say that power meters and power data is overestimated, just the accuracy of them and the ability to compare from device to device. Overrated factor number four is bike frames. So we've already discussed several times how here in this episode, how the best underlying metric correlating with bike performance, which is speed, is watts per CDA. With this in mind, upgrading your bike frame is probably one of the most overrated and for sure the least cost-effective solution you have to improve your bike performance. You can upgrade components such as your front end, your saddle, your crank length, your wheels, your tires, and clothing, and these can all have great impacts on either power, CDA, or both. So for example, crank length and saddle, they might allow you to be in a position that is more comfortable and more aerodynamic, so you can both push more power and have less drag. Investing in coaching and aero consultancy, they can also improve power and CDA respectively. But buying a new bike frame, except if you are on the wrong frame size or you are currently on a road bike and are looking to buy a TT bike, will in almost all cases do very little for you and at a huge cost. So it's probably the last upgrade, or it is the last upgrade you should make. It's really important to make the distinction here between bikes and bike frames, though, because both in triathlon and road cycling, we're seeing incredible times being set, and there are many reasons for that, but the equipment is certainly a very important one. But I think that the equipment in terms of the bike, it is so much more about the components, so things that I mentioned already, comfortable saddles, finding the optimal crank length, custom-made aero bars, which is not something that the typical amateur athlete uses, but the typical top-level pro triathlete certainly uses that. These types of improvements in components and equipment in the modern era of triathlon has allowed athletes to ride in positions that are both very powerful and very aerodynamic. So in a way, every time you get a new bike frame, you almost have to start a long process from scratch with re-optimizing the components, especially if some of the components from your previous bike cannot be moved to the new bike. So a much better investment of time and money in most cases is to continue to work with your current frame, but optimize the setup on that frame by continuously refining that setup, both in terms of components and your position, knowing that this is going to have a much bigger impact on your performance than a new frame could. And I think that most people pragmatically know this about bike frames, but considering how often people do seem to buy new bikes, I think that it is still something that I would classify as vastly overrated in triathlon, and definitely has a place on this list in my opinion. Overrated factor number 5 is almost any compound score. First of all, what do I mean by compound score? Basically, a compound score in this context is a metric that aims to, in some way, synthesize or summarize two or more different metrics or data streams. For example, a very common one is getting some kind of recovery score from a wearable, where the recovery score is a combination of things like HRV, resting heart rate, and sleep duration, maybe sleep quality, maybe some other things as well. There are also several examples of training metrics that are compound scores, including, for example, in swimming, you have the SWOLF score, which is a combination of your the time you took to swim a length and the number of strokes you took, which is basically comes from the concept of swimming golf. So that's where the name comes from. In Training Peaks, for example, if you use Training Peaks, you have metrics like training stress score, which is a combination of duration and intensity for a single workout. Chronic training load, which is basically an accumulation of training stress score over 6 weeks. And efficiency factor is another compound score, which is how an internal load metric like heart rate correlates to an external load metric like pace or power in running or cycling. So some compound scores can definitely be very useful, at least in certain contexts. For example, within one individual athlete, if you have good data hygiene, then chronic training load can give a decent indicator of the relative training load for that athlete. It doesn't tell you anything about whether lower training load or higher training load is better, but it can give you a very good indication of whether your current chronic training load over that rolling 6 week period is higher or lower than it has been before. You can compare this summer compared to last summer, this July 23rd to last year's July 23rd, and so on. And within an individual athlete, you can see if your chronic training load at this moment in time is higher or lower. Comparing two different athletes, however, and even doing comparisons like comparing cycling training load and running training load within an individual athlete, or cycling and swimming within the same athlete, that's no longer useful in any way. It starts to lose the validity of the metric. Efficiency factor similarly has really good utility as a marker of the ratio between internal and external load. When you compare different workouts, as long as certain requirements are fulfilled, so we're talking about steady state workouts, and we're accounting for things like environmental conditions, for example. But again, between two different athletes, it starts to make no sense to compare. And to give you an example of that, I've seen plenty of regular age group athletes with regular age group level performance that can have efficiency factor values that are similar or even higher than professionals. And the same goes for CTL, actually. So it's not, I think that this is the really important thing to keep in mind with these compound metrics, that they have some utility, but in many cases, it's really about comparing yourself to yourself and also with certain other requirements fulfilled. So really understanding the limitations of the metrics. The way that many people use these metrics is what leads me to say that they are overrated, because of the fact that they get used beyond that scope of validity. So a common example here, again, is comparing your chronic training load to your mates. Especially if you are a triathlete and they are a cyclist, then you're violating that scope of validity even further. But it's useless even if you both are triathletes or you're both cyclists. So because it just doesn't mean much. You don't know anything about how they have established the thresholds that are used to calculate the training stress score and so on. So you can use compound scores, but just be aware of their limitations and when you can and cannot use them, and really understand the context behind them. It's important to note as well that most compound scores are designed to in some way simplify data, so you don't have to look at too many data streams. But to have a really good understanding of something, you actually have to look at those individual data streams or individual metrics, not the synthesized, simplified version. So for example, if I were to have a consultation with an athlete and they tell me or show me their chronic training load, but they don't tell me or show me their training volume, nor tell me or show me anything about the intensity of their training, I have nothing to go on. I can't give them any advice or help, because CTL in itself doesn't really tell me much at all. It's a very, very, there's very limited information within there. There is some information, but it's very limited. Almost all of the information is really within those original data streams, within the training volume and the training intensity, and little of it, not none of it, but little of it is maintained when you only have access to that compound score. But often what happens is that we get really into the compound scores because they seem sophisticated and sciencey, but then we neglect those original data sources, and that's where you start to get your priorities wrong, and this is where my whole premise of compound scores being overrated comes from. So compound scores, useful in certain situations, absolutely. But overall, I think overrated and should be used with caution and not instead of the original data streams or metrics that they are trying to synthesize. Overrated factor number 6 is recovery modalities. And by recovery modality, I refer here to anything that isn't sleep, nutrition, and hydration. So the common examples that come to mind here would be things like ice baths or other forms of cryotherapy, compression therapy devices, compression clothing, supplements, and massage. Again, like in previous cases, I'm definitely not saying that all of this is useless. For one thing, placebo does work, and a lot of these modalities do come with some maybe significant placebo effect. So that's something to keep in mind. I also want to give a special mention to massage here, especially as the Tour de France has just finished, and we know that a lot of the teams or riders, if not all of them, tend to get massages. I think that massage is a bit of a special case here because it has the potential to provide a kind of psychological recovery as much as physiological and physical recovery, because it is a human interaction. And if you are a Tour de France cyclist, for example, then the massage you have after dinner can be a good place to just talk through the day with somebody, perhaps vent some frustrations, and that can have a huge impact. So we shouldn't neglect that. It's not just about any potential physical effects. The same can be said for things like compression boots. They kind of force you to rest. I guess the point that I would make here is that if you compare these recovery modalities to sitting at a desk and working intensely, then yes, probably most of them are good. But if we're comparing them to just sleeping, for example, then that's where we start to get into the area of thinking, are they really worth it or are they actually overrated? Again, massage, special case because it has that psychological aspect, not just a physical one. But most of the other ones, I do believe that it's pretty clear cut that probably if you are going to spend some time with a recovery modality, you're probably better off just sleeping, to be honest. If you have, however, back-to-back competitions or back-to-back hard, really hard training days, and you do have a lot of time, so you're a professional athlete, for example, there are things that can work quite well in certain contexts. For example, cryotherapy, when you have high-intensity back-to-back games, for example, if you're a football player or ice hockey player, things like that, those things can work. Less common in triathlon, for sure, to find use cases there. Tour de France or cycling in general, yeah, when you have back-to-back races, you're starting to get into the area where potentially you have some scope to use things like cryotherapy, although in the Tour de France, it's not used, and I think the reason is that there's not enough time in the day. The riders are already, it's already hard enough to get enough sleep because there's actually a lot of, it takes a lot of time when the stage finishes at 5 o'clock and you need to get to the next hotel and you need to eat and all of that. You don't have time to do those things and you choose to just maximize sleep, which makes sense. That's what you should do. But basically, I think that if you are dotting all the I's and crossing all the T's with sleeps and nutrition and hydration, then by all means, you can add these additional modalities if you need to recover even better and even more quickly. You have all the time to do that. You're maybe a professional athlete in a regular at a training camp situation, or you're doing back-to-back races, but you're staying in the same hotel and your races don't take all day long. So you're most likely not going to have any downside by using additional recovery modalities, whether it be ice baths or compression boots and so on. But you could have some additional marginal gains in the best case scenario. But for most amateur athletes, we're coming back here to the age group triathlon case. How often do you get optimal sleep and still have time in the day to go get a massage, for example, or spend 30 to 45 minutes in the compression boots? It's probably only when you're off work on vacation, so it's not in a day-to-day training scenario. And for most amateurs, I assume that it doesn't happen on vacation either. But it could maybe happen if you're at an amateur stage race or something. So that would be a scenario where I could see it being useful to do something like compression boots. From what I've seen in most experienced age group triathletes, they kind of understand already that these modalities are probably not very useful in most cases. So I don't think that this is a category that is hugely overrated on average. It actually, in my experience, tends to be athletes that are quite new to triathlon or new to endurance sports or even sports in general that maybe has the impression that these modalities are really important, something that every athlete needs to use in a normal day-to-day training context. Actually, kind of similarly, that reminds me of stretching, which is something that I see in a lot of athletes that come into the sport and are really new to sport and tend to think that stretching is something that every athlete needs to be doing and that is hugely important for every athlete, which I don't think is the case at all, personally. So I think that, again, this is a subgroup that we're talking about where recovery modalities are overrated, not necessarily the entire endurance community. So I guess to summarize, if you are a busy working athlete, maybe with a family, then any time spent with recovery modalities would probably be better spent sleeping or food prepping. But there are definitely certain special situations, potentially training camps or stage races or similar kind of races or events where it can be useful. But in certain subgroups of the endurance community, especially those newer to endurance sports, I feel like these recovery modalities are overrated. Overrated factor number 7 is lab testing. And lab testing really is the poster child for something that in certain very specific contexts and scenarios can be incredibly useful, but on average for the typical age group triathlete is maybe not useless, but at least not worth the time and money. There is one exception to this, actually, and I'll keep this as a bit of a teaser because the next episode of the podcast will be on underrated factors behind triathlon performance. And there is one specific type of lab testing that can be super useful and well worth the time and money. But it's not the type of testing most people normally think of when we talk about lab testing, which is basically a step or a ramp test or a combination of both. And you would measure lactate or oxygen uptake or both, and in this way establish some thresholds, training zones, maybe VO2 max, So that's not it, but I'll talk more about this, the particular test that I'm thinking of, in the next episode. But now back to typical lab testing. As I said, in certain situations where you really need to solve a puzzle where things don't make sense somehow, perhaps there is a mismatch of training performance and race performance, or a mismatch in your bike and run level. There are certain cases where if you have these questions and you're trying to figure out why you have these mismatches or other questions, then going to the lab can be useful if you have some kind of hypothesis for why you might have these issues that you're trying to solve. Also, of course, the smaller the marginal gains you are trying to find, it can start to make sense to use more lab testing. So, for example, for a professional athlete, a 1% performance gain can make a huge, huge difference. So lab testing could potentially be one place to look for these very small but very important performance gains. But those specific situations where I would consider lab testing useful in the context of amateur triathletes don't happen very often in my experience. And the small chance that they will help you improve performance are a tiny bit, because we're not talking about lab testing making really allowing you to make any huge performance improvements. It is not worth the time and money, in my opinion. And I will explain why. The simple reason is that all of the useful information that you gain from a lab test can pretty easily gain by looking at your power duration or speed duration curve. Now, you can't predict at what power or speed your first ventilatory or lactate threshold or your second ventilatory or lactate threshold will occur necessarily. But knowing that doesn't help you to train well or train quote unquote optimally. Of course, nobody trains optimally, but I definitely don't think that knowing the exact ventilatory threshold or lactate threshold from a lab helps anyone train more optimally than before, especially in an age group triathlon context. But you can predict that your second threshold will occur at a high or a low percentage of VO2 max based on looking at your power duration curve or a speed duration curve. And similarly, whether your first threshold will occur at a high or low percentage of your second threshold or even of your VO2 max. And these are the kinds of pieces of information that are really helpful for making training decisions. It's about your profile as an athlete, not about the exact numbers, because those exact numbers of your thresholds, for example, that you would get from a lab, they are extremely specific to the protocol used. So they are valid for a certain protocol. And if you use a different protocol, for example, let's say you use a step test with steps of 3 minutes of duration, then that will result in one set of first and second thresholds. And if you use instead 6 minute steps, then you will get a different set of first and second thresholds. So which one is right or wrong? Well, one is right for one protocol and the second is right for the other. But that information doesn't really help you train better. So that's basically what I'm getting at. It does, both of those protocols can still show you what kind of profile of an athlete you are, and that can help you train better. But the same goes for just analyzing your power duration curve or your speed duration curve in detail. Doing things like critical power testing can also help you form that critical power curve or critical speed curve. So that's a field test that is free that I think is very useful, not because critical power is so much better than any other threshold metric, but because it allows you to actually profile yourself. So this is the main thing, the gist of why lab testing is probably overrated, because you can get the same information for free by just looking at training data that you already have. And you actually don't even have to formally look at your power duration curve or speed duration curve. You can just qualitatively assess how you perform over varying durations, and that will basically tell you the same thing. So for example, are you faster than your group of running friends over 5K to 10K, but slower over the half and full marathon distance? Or do you do well in bunch rides with town sign sprints? Or do you do well in bunch rides with 30 to 60 minute climbs? These things will tell you a lot about yourself as an athlete, and it can inform training decisions greatly, very similarly to how lab testing could. So the exact numbers that you get in a lab test, again, they are protocol specific, and they are specific to a fresh state, the state that you are at in a lab test. Knowing your fat oxidation or carb oxidation when you're fresh in a ramp test is not the same as knowing it when you're 2 hours into an Ironman ride. So there are so many limitations to lab testing that I think a lot of people don't think about. But what you really get out of it is the same as you get out of profiling that you can do for free anyway. So I could make an entire episode just on this topic, so I'll have to leave out a lot. But the final thing that I would say is that not all lab testing is created equal. So in the cases, the few cases where I would suggest that an athlete should do a lab test, then I never just say, hey, go and do a lab test. I would say, go and do this lab test, and I would give them a specific protocol that I want them to use, which depends on the athlete and what we try to figure out. And if the lab doesn't agree to work with a specific protocol requested by the athlete, then this is a lab that I would really avoid, because that probably also reflects the quality of the rest of their work. So to summarize this point, I don't necessarily see a lot of triathletes going into the lab all the time. So it's probably not a factor that is all that overrated, because actually not a lot of people are really using it to a great extent. It's not like the new bike phenomenon that I see a lot. But just in offline and online discourse, I still think that there is a noticeable kind of overestimation for the potential benefits of lab testing compared to what I actually think they are in practice. And other than that one exception that I will talk about in the next episode, so bring in that teaser once again to make sure you tune in for the next episode. All right, overrated factor number 8 is workout design and workout details. So this one, and probably the next one as well, might be a bit surprising, maybe a bit controversial. So let me explain what I mean more clearly. Of course, workout design and workout details are not unimportant. Otherwise, you might become a world champion by just exercising rather than training. But what I mean is that I think that the finer details are overrated. So for example, clearly the difference between doing a long easy ride or a long ride with lots of Ironman pace work or a long ride with several sets of VO2 max intervals is quite significant and matters quite a bit. But let's say that we have decided already that what we're going to do is a long ride with Ironman pace work. Does it matter if your Ironman pace intervals are 20, 40, or 60 minutes long, if you still end up doing, let's say, 2 hours worth of work at Ironman pace? I don't think it matters much. I think it matters extremely little. It still matters a little, don't get me wrong, but I think that these types of fine details are things that a lot of people spend way too much time thinking about, when the important things to think about are the ones that make a big difference in the end, and that is whether you should do the ride with Ironman pace in the first place, or should it be that easy ride or that long ride with VO2 max intervals instead. That's the big decision or the big ticket item. And the other, you could also take it even further. Should you even train, or should you maybe take a rest day on that day? That's another big ticket item. Should you ride on the TT bike or on the road bike? Should you ride on hilly terrain, flat terrain, or indoors? Should you ride early in the morning or in the heat of the afternoon on a hot summer day? These are the big things that matter a lot more. So spend your time thinking about these things, not the tiny details like, are you doing 20-minute intervals with 4-minute rests or 40-minute intervals with 8-minute rests, for example. Another example of how the finer details are overrated is in the specific intensity. So it's quite common for people to assign a single power or pace as their target intensity and rigidly adhere to that, no matter how correct or incorrect that target might be in the first place. So this can actually be very counterproductive, I think, as the intensity could be either too high or too low, and neither one is, of course, any good. So it's much better to have a pretty wide range that you're using as your target range, and then adjust within that range based on how things are going on the day, based on even things like the temperature and so on, to find the optimal intensity for that workout for that day. And especially on easy days, if you even have a range of power or pace or heart rate, it should be extremely wide and allow you to go very easy if needed. And it might be more of, rather than a range, just have a maximum pace or power that you should not exceed, rather than having a target range. So I would say that these are the main two examples of how workout details are overrated. The precision of intensity, so for example, wanting to ride at exactly 100% of quote-unquote FTP rather than just setting a range of 90 to 100%. And the specific design of work and rest intervals, for example, deciding between 2 or 3 minute VO2 max intervals. As long as the total amount of work is the same, then that's still a pretty big and important question. But how you split that amount of work and that amount of rest probably matters very little. I will say, and this is something that I may talk more about in a future episode, for the bike in particular, I think that erg mode is something that is impairing some athletes' training quite a bit. Because when you get used to doing all of your training in erg mode, and specifically if you have a start the workout and then stop thinking mentality, then this is a situation where I think you really risk stagnation. Because to write those workouts and program them in erg mode is to almost be, by default, be lured into thinking about the details rather than the bigger picture. So I would like to actually issue a challenge to every listener of the podcast here to try to do the next 4 weeks of training with not using erg mode a single time. You can still do indoor training as much as you want, just don't use erg mode. And I think for some, this could result in really, really fantastic and probably surprising progress. All right, let's move on to item number 9 on this list, which is specificity. So I'm not sure if this is how you perceive it, but I feel like I'm talking about specificity quite a lot. So from that perspective, it is probably quite surprising to hear me say that specificity is overrated. But again, overrated is not the same as not useful. What led me to include specificity on the list is that there is, again, a subgroup of athletes that are really, really focused on their training for, it might be 2, 3, 4, even 5 months before their A race, which might be an Ironman, just as an example, and put a lot of mental and physical effort into that period. So they're really thinking about their training, trying to be really specific and all of that, but they get basically the same results year after year in that A race, which is fine if you just want to do it, but I think a lot of athletes want to go faster and improve. And what I think happens is that in many cases, the rest of the year is just a complete afterthought, maybe with very little training or even no training at all throughout some periods. And of course, fitness then will be very reduced by the time you get to the point where you need to start focusing again on that next race, which might be in 5 months from now. It's not quite a build from scratch, but it's close enough. So to bring this back to specificity and try to explain what I mean, no matter how good your training is in those 4 months, no matter how specific it is, no matter how well you take care of everything around training as well, when you let your fitness fall so much during the rest of the year, you're only ever going to reach a certain level. And when you get to a certain point of having done this cycle for a few years, it's generally going to be the same level that you've already been at before. So we see here, fitness beats specificity. And by an incredible amount, every single time. What we're lacking here is not specificity. It's not the good, excellent training. There's nothing wrong with the training in those 4 months. It's perfect, if there is such a thing as perfect training. But there's just not fitness, because fitness comes from consistent training throughout basically almost the entire year. So that's, of course, an extreme example. But what about the case of somebody who is training basically year-round, with a season break of about 2 weeks, which I would typically recommend for the typical age group triathlete? You're doing all the right things for your fitness. Is specificity leading into a key race overrated in this example? I do think it is still a bit overrated, and lots of athletes spend a bit too long, I would say, doing race specificity, especially for athletes who already have a mature training age, so basically lots of experience in the sport, and also lots of racing experience. I think that in these cases, the amount of specificity needed leading into a key race is shorter than most people think. An experienced Ironman athlete doesn't necessarily need more than 3 to 5 weeks of really specific training, for example, if the base fitness is there and they have the race experience and the training experience, training maturity. Somebody newer to the sport and maybe training for their first Ironman, they would benefit, in my opinion, from a slightly longer period of specificity, for sure, but not excessively long. So I have, for example, consulted with athletes doing 12 weeks or more filled with Ironman specificity, and it doesn't really matter, or race specificity, I should say, because it doesn't matter what race you're training for, because I think that that is often a recipe for stagnation at best and injury and burnout at worst. So for to give you an example, if you have been using some of the ready-made training plans that we have on scientifictriathlon.com, you will know that we have a 26-week long beginner full distance training plan. In this plan, the Ironman specific work is in the last 6 to 7 weeks of the plan. So sure, you start to build up to longer durations of riding and running and swimming before that, but it's still all kind of a general preparation, building your general fitness and getting you ready to do the specific work in that pretty short specific period of 6 to 7 weeks. And then in some of the more advanced plans, you can have even slightly shorter specific periods of race specificity, of Ironman specificity in the case of the full distance. So to finish off this point, a very good athlete, I think, can do very well in, or I know, can do very well in an event with zero specific training. For example, take any world-class short course triathlete and put them in an Ironman with zero specific training. They will not perform to their potential or the Ironman distance. They certainly won't beat an equally talented athlete that has specialized training for that distance. But by the standards of the majority of the athletes in the world, they will put in an incredible performance just based on the general fitness and skill within triathlon that they have with absolutely no specific training. Of course, you should do specific training. It is important. But I still think it's perhaps slightly overrated because fitness basically is what really matters much, much more rather than specificity. And I think that the duration of specific training periods that I sometimes see athletes doing would speak for this as well, that specificity maybe is a little bit overrated. So yeah, I think that I hope that I explained this well, because of course I'm a big believer in specific training, but it's just how it relates, how it compares to other aspects of general fitness and how much of it you need to be doing. Overrated factor number 10, the penultimate one on the list, is most wearables and sensors. So firstly, I would say here that the ones that I would not include, the ones that are definitely not overrated, include your GPS watch, your bike computer, your heart rate monitor, and your power meter, even despite what I said earlier about power data and power meters. As I explained, the overrated thing is not the power meter itself, but just the accuracy of the absolute numbers and comparing between different power meters. Those devices, those sensors and wearables, whatever you want to call them, they are definitely not overrated. They are super useful for any triathlete. What I would include in this list, however, are things like wearables, measuring recovery, sleep trackers. And again, we talked about this a bit in the part about compound scores. Also things like lactate meters, oxygen saturation sensors, different biomechanics sensors, and so on. There are a couple of types of sensors that I think as a concept have great potential, but I'm unsure if they today, as they are, have accurate enough and usable enough, are accurate enough and usable enough to be a good investment for the typical athlete. I think not. But I think that they might make sense for coaches to play around with and maybe lend to their athletes to use under guidance to get specific data. And the types that I'm talking about here are aerodynamic sensors, so basically CDA measurements. And these I have quite a lot of experience with myself, using under guidance of an expert, mostly from one brand, to be fair. But I have seen others in use a little bit as well. And the second one is core temperature sensors. And this is one of the only types of sensors that I can even think of that I actually don't have any experience with myself. And I'm quite curious to try it out, because to me, that concept really does have legs and makes a lot of sense. And I would speculate that similar to power meters, they might not get to a point of being completely accurate, but if they get to a point of being very precise, then they could be extremely useful. However, I should also point out that I also had extremely high hopes for something like oxygen saturation sensors. In theory, it makes a ton of sense to me, but in practice, I found the utility really lacking. So oftentimes, I think things just seem so much better on paper than they end up being in practice. And that's probably an important lesson for everybody. But certainly for me, that has been the case for me because I have purchased a lot of sensors in my day. But anyway, back to the overrated sensors that I definitely think are overrated. This category is pretty similar in a way to how I described lab testing, that in certain cases and scenarios, using specific wearables and sensors in a controlled and well thought through protocol to try to answer a specific question or set of questions can be extremely useful. So I have used this example before, I believe, but for athletes coming to triathlon or endurance sports from a different sporting background, where the demands are perhaps much more intermittent and explosive, so let's say team sports like football or soccer, it can be really useful for this type of athlete, especially if it's a high-level athlete, to do a lactate step test to get a better idea of their metabolic profile, and especially to make sure that they don't do their easy training too hard. This has just been my anecdotal experience. And you can find some example like that probably for almost any of the wearables or sensors on the market, where you're using them for a specific purpose and they can be really useful. But the reason that I say that most wearables and sensors are overrated is that I think that there is this perception that you get any of these wearables and you start collecting data and then it will somehow help you train or perform better. And I can pretty much guarantee that it won't. And in some cases, it will do the opposite. Because if you start to use data from these sensors as first or second order priority, when probably it should be no higher than third, or maybe first or second, but only in the very specific question you're trying to answer, then these wearables and sensors, essentially, they are red herrings, but you're using them as something that gets undue importance in your training process. So that's how I would describe it. So if we take the example of recovery and sleep trackers, these can, for example, go one of two ways. If you use them to, and maybe you notice that, oh, you're actually getting less sleep on average than you realized, and you just use this information very simply to make some simple changes to your sleep hygiene and bedtime habits and you start sleeping more and better, then this is, of course, an extremely positive and useful outcome. But we have to remember that the opposite can happen, and it is a very observed effect these days, where there is this concept of orthosomnia, where if you over-obsess about the metrics, your sleep in general, in the knowledge that you will have some quantitative data in the morning about your sleep quality, you actually end up sleeping less or sleeping worse due to the anxiety over your sleep and your sleep data. So again, that is called orthosomnia. You can look it up. And with this in mind, if we think about whether the potential downside of these devices outweighs the upside, I think it does, because it's pretty easy to work on improving one's sleep without any of these devices. You can just keep a sleep duration log, pen and paper, or a note on your phone. Same thing with sleep quality, especially considering that any sleep quality metric you will get from a tracker will be dubious at best anyway, so it's not really all that accurate. So how you feel is probably a better marker of how good the quality of your sleep was. But considering all of this, I would think very carefully about adding sleep trackers to somebody. And that being said, there are some individuals for sure for whom these devices and trackers can be really good and motivating, and it does actually help them form better sleep habits. That's awesome. I think that if that's you, go for it by all means. But I just think that on average, these devices are overrated, because on average, I think that the potential downsides actually outweigh the potential upside. So that's a bit more about sleep trackers, and also the same also goes for recovery tracking in general, I would say. One other device that I want to talk about in a bit more detail here is lactate meters. This is a device that has become very trendy, or measuring lactate has become very trendy in recent years. And of all the devices that I mentioned, it's the one that I have used the most. I've used lactate quite a lot, to be fair. And I think that it can be very useful to answer specific questions. But it also has a long and steep learning curve to really use it well and to understand how to use it and its limitations. It's easy to get samples. It's easy to see the numbers and maybe think about some hypothesis for why the number is what it is and what to do. But that's not the same as really, it's information. It's not knowledge. And knowledge is also not the same as wisdom. So you're moving on that spectrum when it comes to lactate. It's a learning curve, and it's pretty long and steep. So it's not a device that I recommend to any athlete, unless you have a coach who is experienced in the use of lactate and can and will tell you exactly how to use it. From my perspective, I think that using it in training, in day-to-day training for intensity control, is a waste of time. It's not precise, so consistent enough for that. I find that it can be useful for formal testing, but for me, it isn't the tool that I would use in day-to-day training at all. And I think that lactate, with the amount of attention that it has received in recent years, is a very clear example of a device that, for a typical age group triathlete that goes and buys one and starts using it in testing, but also if especially if you use it in day-to-day training, I would say that chances are that you might impair your training quality rather than improve it. So if you want to use lactate, you really should seek out expert guidance there. And I think that this leads me to a general point with wearables and devices and even data in general. They really increase the risk of falling into naive interventionism, where we choose to take some action when taking no action would have been better. So lactate, for example, if you use it in day-to-day training, you might change your workout in a way that you wouldn't have otherwise, but it's not really clear that that was the best decision. And I think that, yeah, we can easily fall into this trap when we put too much stock into certain metrics and certain devices and wearables without really understanding them. So to summarize and wrap up this point, I would say that most wearables and sensors, again, there were some exceptions that I mentioned early on, GPS watch, biocomputer, heart rate monitor, power meter, but most other ones are overrated because, one, in some cases there are question marks around accuracy and or precision and or relevance. Two, if the device is accurate and precise, it is assumed that just by measuring more things, you will be able to train and perform better, which is not the case. So lactate being a good example of that. Number three is that to actually use the data well often comes with a lot of investment of time and or money to learn and understand how to use this device and all of its limitations. So again, lactate, but also aerosensors is a great example here. Really, like, take steep learning curve, takes a long time to really understand how to use. I don't, but I have friends that do and colleagues that do. So I rely on them. And number four, we tend to only think about the potential upside, not the potential downside. So again, this leads us a bit to the concept of naive interventionism as well, that we might actually make harm. And the example with sleep trackers was what is a clear one of that. So this leads us to the final point on the list, factor number 11, that is overrated for triathlon performance. And that is what I would call, or what I have termed here, addition by addition. I'm not sure if this term makes sense, but most of you have probably heard about addition by subtraction, which essentially means that sometimes the best way to make progress is to eliminate elements that are hindering development and growth, rather than continually trying to add new elements to reach that progress. So when I say that addition by addition is overrated, what I mean is that a lot of athletes are always looking for the one next thing that they are missing, or that they can add to their arsenal to take the next step in their development. So this is where how I think about addition by addition. So, and yeah, we're thinking about the things to add rather than paying any attention to if we should actually remove anything. We have a tendency to have a bit of shiny object syndrome, and we're chasing that next best workout or training program or diet or supplement or piece of equipment or data in the hope that this will be the element that we can add to make us perform better. But it's much more rare to see athletes analyzing what they should remove in order to get better. But in my coaching experience, the real dramatic gains that you can sometimes see, especially when starting to work with a new athlete, often comes by removing things, not by adding things. And to give you three very specific examples that come to mind, one, removing a lot of the intensity that an athlete has been doing when they've clearly been doing too much. That is a great example of how removing something can lead to great progress. Two, removing some self-imposed diets can also really, really work well. Especially when that diet has led to some kind of caloric restriction that should not be there. And number three, removing sources of life stress, for example, working too much. If somebody's just overworked and burnt out, then when you remove that life stress, and it might take an objective outside observer to notice that that's actually something that you need, not just for your triathlon performance, but for your general health and longevity. So those are three very clear examples that happens quite a bit, and you never see any gains as dramatic by adding something as you see when you have an athlete where removing something like this can lead to that big progress. So basically what I'm saying is that most of us, not just in triathlon, but professionally and personally as well, tend to always look for things to add, to grow, to develop. And sometimes this certainly is the answer, but often the opposite is the answer. We should be removing element, but way fewer people think about this aspect than about adding elements. So in other words, addition by addition is overrated, considering that so many times the better answer is found in addition by subtraction. So that wraps up point number 11, and that wraps up our list of overrated factors for triathlon performance. I do hope that you enjoyed that episode, and I'm very curious to hear your feedback. Please send it to me on michael@scientifictriathlon.com. And as always, you can find the show notes on scientifictriathlon.com with any relevant links. I don't really think there are any links in particular that I will put in here, but if I think of something or we find them in the show notes writing process, then we'll add them. But this episode leads me nicely to promoting our coaching services a little bit. This is what we do to make a living here at Scientific Triathlon. Triathlon can be a pretty overwhelming sport, even for experienced and high-performing athletes, because there is just too much calling for your attention and that you could choose to spend your time on, including various metrics and devices, including thinking about the smaller details of workout design, wondering if you need to buy a new bike or perhaps a plunge tub, and so on and so forth. So this is a perfect example of where working with an experienced coach can save you a lot of time and money, because they will help you focus on the things that matter and don't worry about the rest. As I've said before, it's quite common for athletes, especially those who have never had a coach, or at least not a coach that works the way that we do, they think that coaching is all about the training program that you're getting and just getting on with the training program and following that program. And yes, the training program is of course important, but equally important is this help in focusing in on the right things and stopping the focus on the wrong things. Watts per kilogram is a very good example where we have had a fair few athletes that have come to us from a perspective of wanting to improve their watts per kg. So they try to lose weight and end up tanking their performance completely as a result. And in this scenario, what we do as coaches is to explain why that focus on watts per kg and weight in general is misguided, and then steer that focus onto a different, better path. And this alone, regardless of what the actual training looks like, would generally lead to huge performance improvements. And while this example is probably an obvious one to most, and I know most listeners are too smart to fall into that trap, I would say that most people have some things that they focus on where this focus could be redirected to something else and result in pretty quick and significant improvements. So if you're interested in being coached by us, go and visit scientifictriathlon.com/coaching to learn more. You can read about all of our coaches, and you can email me again, that is michael@scientifictriathlon.com, to learn more and to set up a free discovery call. We are very dedicated to our craft, and we hope to help as many listeners as possible with whatever your goals may be and whatever your level is. In the next episode, as I teased a bit already, I will follow up this one with a list of underrated factors for triathlon performance. I don't know how many they will be, but based on the initial planning I've done, it will be at least as many as the 11 we had today, but let's see. I might trim it or I might find more, but regardless, I think it will be an even more useful episode than today's, because while today's was more about the things that for most triathletes are not so important, next week's is about the things that actually are important. So I would say that it will be more directly actionable for a lot of you. So I hope that you tune in for that. Finally, big thanks to our sponsors, Precision Fuel Hydration. You can find on precisionfuelhydration.com. If you're looking for high quality, practical, and tasty fueling and hydration products, make sure to try Precision Fuel Hydration. There are a range of options from drink mix to gels to choose, so you can easily find your personal favorite. Don't forget to take 15% off your first order with the code TTS24. And thank you to Zenate. The Zenate Swim Trainer is a great tool to have in your toolbox to improve your technique and power, to target specific aspects of your stroke, and to maintain consistency when you don't have time to get to the pool. You can try the Zenate risk-free for up to 30 days and get 20% off your first order on zenateswimtrainer.com/TTS. Thank you, as always, for listening. Keep training smart and keep loving triathlon.